Today is Friday, January 8th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump acknowledges he will soon be out of office.
A new administration will be inaugurated on January 20th.
Plus, there's growing discussion of removing President Trump from office. Also ahead, South Africa set to roll out COVID-19 vaccines.
A ray of hope for the Rainbow Nation, which over a 24-hour period saw a massive spike in confirmed COVID-19 cases.
These stories and more are next. In a video released Thursday night, President Donald Trump said he is outraged by, quote, violence, lawlessness, and mayhem, unquote, that transpired when his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol this week. Trump is facing a growing call from Democrats and Republicans who say he must be removed from office. White House correspondent Patsy Wedakuswara reports.
With scenes of his supporters violently storming into the U.S. Capitol fresh in mind, Thursday night President Donald Trump released a video addressing the attack.
Like all Americans, I am outraged by the violence, lawlessness, and mayhem.
Trump acknowledged that Congress has certified the election result, but did not congratulate President-elect Joe Biden, as is the norm in a concession speech.
My focus now turns to ensuring a smooth, orderly, and seamless transition of power.
Earlier Thursday, Biden delivered another sharp rebuke of Trump.
He unleashed an all-out assault on our institutions of our democracy from the outset. And yesterday was but the culmination of that unrelenting attack.
Biden did not address the growing calls to remove Trump from office for inciting mob violence, including from presumptive Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who are pushing to invoke the 25th Amendment.
By inciting sedition, as he did yesterday, he must be removed from office. While it's only 13 days left, any day can be a horror show for America.
Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger also called for Trump's ousting.
All indications are that the president has become unmoored, not just from his duty, nor even his oath, but from reality itself.
The 25th Amendment allows the removal of a president who is unable to discharge the powers and duties through a vote by the vice president and a majority of the cabinet. Neither Vice President Mike Pence nor any cabinet member has publicly supported the move. John Fortier is the executive director of the Continuity of Government Commission at the American Enterprise Institute.
With the remaining time, I think there would be some obstacles, both practical and legal, to doing it. So it could be done, but it would be very hard to do.
Meanwhile, a federal prosecutor investigating the riot has said he would press charges against anyone inciting it, potentially including Trump, who told supporters to march to Congress to press lawmakers to block certification of Biden's victory. For months, he has said he can only lose if the election is rigged. Jason Grumet is the president of the Bipartisan Policy Center.
The images are shocking and sad, and I think the unfortunate but somewhat predictable conclusion of the president's denigration of democracy.
Pelosi said that if Pence won't invoke the 25th Amendment, the House would consider impeaching Trump again. He was impeached in late 2019, but acquitted by the Senate in February 2020. Patsy Wedakuswara, VOA News.
As a steady stream of Trump administration officials head for the exits, including Education Secretary Betsy DeVos and Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, there's growing discussion of removing President Trump from office, either by invoking the 25th Amendment or impeaching him again. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Neither option seems likely. With only a dozen days left in his term, there's little time to either organize impeachment hearings and a trial or draft the cabinet members needed to invoke the amendment. Meantime, two cabinet secretaries have resigned in protest of the Capitol attack. Education's Betsy DeVos and Transportation's Elaine Chao, who is married to Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
That's Sagar Magani of AP. A police officer has died from injuries sustained as President Trump's supporters stormed the Capitol, intensifying questions about the defeated president's remaining days in office and the ability of the Capitol Police to secure the area. The U.S. Capitol Police said Officer Brian D. Sicknick died Thursday after being injured, quote, while physically engaging with protesters, unquote, during the Wednesday riot. He's the fifth person to die in the melee. Several security figures on Capitol Hill have left their jobs since Wednesday riot. AP correspondent Mark Garcia reports.
The fallout from Wednesday's shocking rush on the U.S. Capitol by a mob of Trump supporters is costing several individuals their jobs. U.S. Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund will resign effective January 16th. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called for Sund's resignation, which was confirmed to the AP by a person familiar with the matter. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell asked Senate Sergeant-at-Arms Michael Stenger to resign, and he did so effective immediately. And House Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irving, another key security official, also submitted his resignation. Mike Gracia, Washington.
The assault by supporters of President Donald Trump, forcing members of Congress who were in the process of certifying President-elect Joe Biden's victory to evacuate the chambers for several hours. VOA's Caroline Presutti returned to the Capitol on Thursday and described the scene to International Edition's Steve Miller.
It was surprisingly calm. There were, I would say, dozens of police officers, probably hundreds of police officers around the Capitol, both on the grounds and on the street. They were various police officers, National Guard out in full force, DC police officers, state police, both from Maryland and Virginia. They even had their vehicles lined up on the street around the Capitol. So the police are in force. People are curious. They're walking around the Capitol, but very calm. It's very quiet. It would be like a regular day if not for the police presence.
Carolyn, what can you tell us about security at the Capitol? Because there has been a lot of criticism leveled at law enforcement for not securing the building. And in fact, senators have also called for the sergeant at arms to resign or be fired when the new administration begins. So what can you tell us about the security moving forward?
Absolutely, Steve. You're right. There's a lot of controversy surrounding the security. Capitol Police saying that they were prepared, others saying they were terribly outnumbered and they did not have those fence barriers in place that they typically have when they are expecting this size of crowd. Now, also, you have to keep in mind that this protest wasn't slated to be at the Capitol per se, so that could have been part of the problem. It was only after the president spoke that then the protest moved to the Capitol and that they breached the perimeter. And they actually went in areas that I have never been in, and I have a Capitol Hill credential. So you saw them scaling the walls of the Capitol, breaking through the windows inside the members' offices, sitting in their chairs, moving their chairs, turning them over, sitting in the chamber, something we have never seen before in this country. But what has taken place to assure this from never happening again is astounding. Because while we were there at the Capitol today, they were erecting 3-meter high fencing all around the Capitol, huge black fences. This is a large perimeter around the Capitol. We're not talking about right next to the building. We're talking about all the way on the grass next to the street.
Carolyn, you had the opportunity to speak to a Trump supporter who was at the Capitol on Wednesday. What can you tell us about their experience?
Right. He was from Branson, Missouri. He said he came in specifically for this rally, for this pro-Trump rally, and he made it all the way up to the balcony of the Capitol. Again, you cannot be on that balcony without a special credential on a normal day. So for anyone from the public who has not gone through a metal detector, who does not have the right credentialing, who does not have a reason to be on that balcony, it's amazing that they got that far.
That's International Edition's Steve Miller speaking with VOA's Caroline Presutti. As investigations into the Capitol attack intensify, President-elect Joe Biden has introduced Merrick Garland as his pick for Attorney General, along with 3 others he has selected for senior Justice Department positions. Biden says they will restore the independence of the agency and faith in the rule of law.
More than anything, we need to restore the honor, the integrity, the independence of the Department of Justice in this nation has been so badly damaged. And so many former leaders of that department and both parties have so testified and stated that. I want to be clear to those who lead this department who you will serve. You won't work for me. You are not the president or the vice president's lawyer. Your loyalty is not to me. It's to the law, the Constitution, the people of this nation, to guarantee justice. For Attorney General of the United States, I nominate a man of impeccable integrity, Judge Merrick Garland, one of the most respected jurists of our time, brilliant yet humble, distinguished yet modest, full of character and decency. A Supreme Court clerk served in the Justice Department during the Carter, Bush 41, and Clinton administrations, where he embraced the department's core values of independence and integrity. A federal prosecutor who took on terrorism and corruption and violent crime, always with the utmost professionalism and the duty to the oath he swore. Nominated by President Clinton to be a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, considered the second most powerful court in America. Throughout such a long and distinguished career, Judge Garland has earned the praise and admiration of members of bench and bar and politicians of both parties.
This is the Voice of America. U.S. employers shed jobs last month for the first time since April, cutting 140,000 positions, evidence that the economy is faltering as the COVID-19 pandemic tightens its grip on consumers and businesses. The unemployment rate stayed at 6.7%, the first time it hasn't fallen since April. Friday figures from the Labor Department suggest that employers have rehired roughly all the workers they can afford to have after having laid off more than 22 million in the spring, the worst such loss on record. The biggest crematorium in the Czech Republic has been overwhelmed by mounting numbers of pandemic victims. With new confirmed COVID-19 infections remaining at record highs, the situation looks set to worsen. Authorities in the northeastern city of Ostrava have been speeding up plans to build a fourth furnace, but in the meantime have sought help from government's Central Crisis Committee for Pandemic Coordination. A court in Pakistan has sentenced a suspect in the 2008 terrorist attacks on Mumbai to 5 years in jail in a terror financing case. The Special Terrorism Court in Lahore convicted Lakhvi Lakhur Rehman Lekhi of running a medical facility to raise funds to finance terrorism. The anti-terrorism department in Pakistan's Punjab province released the ruling details Friday. Lakhvi is allegedly the chief of operations of the Lashkar-e-Taiba group, which India and the United States accused of plotting the 2008 Mumbai attacks, which killed 166 people. The United Arab Emirates has announced it will reopen its borders and airspace to Qatar after boycotting the tiny, energy-rich country alongside its Gulf allies since 2017. An Emirate Foreign Ministry official says the decision to restart commerce and travel will take effect on Saturday. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. On Friday, Indonesia released from prison Islamic cleric Abu Bakar Bashir. Authorities said the suspected mastermind of the 2002 Bali bombings would enter a de-radicalization program amid concerns over his continued influence in extremist circles. Reuters' Libby Hogan reports.
He was the accused mastermind behind the Bali bombings, attacks that struck several nightclubs in the Bar district of Kuta in 2002, killing 202 people, including 88 Australians. And on Friday, Islamic cleric Abu Bakar Bashir was released from prison in Indonesia's West Java province after he served 10 years in prison.
He was imprisoned in 2011 for 15 years for his links to a militant training camp, but his jail term was reduced. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said Bashir's release is distressing to victims' families, but added that Australia has to respect Indonesia's justice system.
I still remember that day very vividly, like I'm sure many Australians do. It's hard and it's gut-wrenching, having spent time with the families of those victims of that terrible bombing. We have always called for those who were involved to face tougher, proportionate and just sentences in these cases.
82-year-old Bashir is regarded as the spiritual leader of Jamaa Islamiya, a jihadist network with ties to al-Qaeda. The Bali bombings were the single worst attack on Australian citizens from an act of terror. Many of them were on holiday at the island's popular beach resorts. Although Indonesian police and Western intelligence agencies say he was involved with a deadly bombing a year later at Jakarta's Marriott Hotel, he was never convicted for those attacks and denied those ties. While in jail, he also pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. Other extremist groups have since formed in the world's biggest Muslim-majority country. And Bashir's son told Reuters ahead of his father's release he would return to Al Mukmin, an Islamic boarding school founded by Bashir, whose graduates have been linked to militant networks. Authorities said Bashir would enter a program for de-radicalization.
That was Libby Hogan with Reuters. When will Africa get the coveted COVID-19 vaccine? In South Africa, the continent's virus epicenter, the health minister says health workers and vulnerable people will go first, getting vaccines in the next 2 months, with the bulk of the population getting them by the end of 2021. Elsewhere on the continent, officials from the World Health Organization said they are determined that low-income countries also get equitable access. VOA's Anita Power reports from Johannesburg.
A ray of hope for the Rainbow Nation, which over a 24-hour period saw a massive spike in confirmed COVID-19 cases. The vaccine is coming this month. On Thursday, Health Minister William Kize announced that South Africa will receive 1 million vaccine doses by the end of January, and another 500,000 in February, both from the Serum Institute of India. The first doses, he says, will go to health workers. Mkhize acknowledged that South Africa's vaccine acquisition was delayed because the nation was unable to pay for vaccines that were still in development, a tactic used by wealthier nations. But he vowed it will catch up. South Africa's limited budget also led officials to choose the cheapest vaccine option, offered by AstraZeneca.
We will be making sure that we bring the vaccines as quickly as possible into South Africa. By the time we start the vaccination program, we won't be very far different from many countries. We would actually be all in line with most of the countries. So we would like to assure the public that, in fact, we are all on course insofar as this matter is concerned.
That heartening news came after the country, which is Africa's viral hotspot, reported what Nkiza described as a grim milestone, surpassing 20,000 new cases in a 24-hour period. And he says the situation gets worse from there, as the nation enters a second wave that features a new variant of the virus that appears to be spreading much, much faster.
The deaths are already higher than what we ever experienced before. The admissions are already higher than what we experienced before. The new cases on a seven-day average are also already higher than what we experienced before.
South Africa has now seen more than 1.1 million cases since the virus first arrived in March. The National Institute for Communicable Diseases says that 31,368 people have died in South Africa. Once South Africa's health workers are vaccinated, a second round of vaccinations will target 17 million people, including essential workers, teachers, the elderly, and those with other health conditions that put them at higher risk. In the end, Mkhize said, the nation hopes to vaccinate about 40 million people within the year, about 67% of the population. That figure is close to what health experts say is the threshold for herd immunity. How about the rest of the continent? Dr. Kate O'Brien is a WHO's Director of Immunization, Vaccines and Biologicals. She described the process by which 92 of the world's poorest nations can get access to the vaccine through the COVAX facility, a global initiative of 192 countries that is trying to ensure equitable access.
For countries that can afford it, they're paying for the vaccines that are coming through the COVAX facility. For countries, 92 countries that are less able to actually purchase these vaccines on their own, from their own domestic funds. There are donor funds that have been provided. We need about $7 billion in order to deliver enough vaccine to these countries through the end of 2021. And the facility has already raised about $6 billion of the $7 billion. So the facility has access to over 2 billion doses of vaccine. And we will start to deliver those vaccines probably by the end of January. And if not, then certainly by early February and mid-February. So that's how countries in Africa and South Asia and other countries around the world, of these 92 that are less able to afford vaccines, are actually going to get vaccine. And laying them out and rolling them out at the same time that high-income countries are rolling out their vaccines.
Dr. O'Brien emphasized that people with HIV, South Africa carries the world's highest burden of that virus, should be vaccinated. But pregnant and breastfeeding women should discuss the vaccine with healthcare providers before making a decision. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Israel is a world leader in number of COVID-19 vaccinations, with 15% of the population already vaccinated. At the same time, the number of coronavirus infections is spiraling and Israel is going into another tight lockdown. Linda Grustin reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
As of midnight on Thursday, all schools and non-essential businesses will close down, all gatherings will be outlawed, and Israelis are supposed to stay home for at least 2 weeks to try to get the numbers of new COVID-19 cases down. Shlomi Kaddish is the director general of the Soroka Hospital in the southern Israeli city of Be'er Sheva.
So regretfully, we're seeing a surge in cases that is today beyond what we saw in the previous wave of COVID-19 illness. We're currently seeing 7,000 new patients daily over that. We're performing a lot of tests, a lot of vaccinations, but we're seeing a lot of seriously ill patients. We're currently at 873 critically sick patients nationwide, which is a number that is considered around the threshold of the healthcare system capacity.
This is the third time that Israel has gone to a lockdown since the COVID-19 crisis began last March. In previous times, various sectors of the population ignored the rules. Ultra-Orthodox Jews kept their religious schools open, and many among the Arab population continued to hold large weddings. This time, the wedding season is open, and influential ultra-Orthodox rabbis have called for schools to close at least for a few days. Shlomi Kaddish from Soroka Hospital believes Israel could have avoided this total lockdown.
If we had better public trust, better understanding of what the deal really is here, we would have been able to implement less strict measures 2 or 3 weeks ago. Regretfully, we're now at a point where disease patterns are spiraling out of control, and we need to fully lock down the Israeli public activity altogether.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has promised that Israel will be the first country to beat the coronavirus and open the economy. Israel rolled out a vaccine program less than 3 weeks ago that has seen more than 1.5 million Israelis, most of them over 60 or with chronic conditions, vaccinated. Part of the reason the government was able to move so fast is that every Israeli is a member of one of four health insurance plans that keeps computerized medical records. Israel is also a small country with just over 9 million people. Israeli press reports say that Israel has paid Pfizer about $30 per dose, significantly more than other countries, to ensure millions of doses of its vaccine. Israel is also expected to get the Moderna vaccine in the coming days. 2 weeks after receiving their second dose of the vaccine, Israelis will get a green passport that will enable them to travel freely, avoid quarantine when returning from abroad, and participate in cultural events. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.